Good morning. So, last time we talked a bit more about RISC and CISC. So we said that these were two different sort of philosophies for making instruction sets. When we're making instruction sets, we're often thinking about what we think a typical hardware implementation will look like. And in the RISC philosophy, we're kind of thinking, okay, I want the hardware to be efficient and simple, and my instruction set's purpose is kind of to expose what the hardware does well. Versus the CISC philosophy, where we're more thinking from the perspective of who's writing assembly or the compilers, and I want to, in the CISC philosophy, we're going to try to choose the instructions we think the compilers and assembly writers want, and you know, if they're complicated to implement, that's fine. So these are kind of two, you know, historical variations, and probably most modern instruction sets are kind of in between these two philosophies. But kind of the RISC way is that we say, okay, the purpose of my instruction set is to expose what hardware does, and the compiler can figure out how to take advantage of that. Is kind of the basic idea. Then we talked about the instruction set we'll be using for our processors that we're going to build in a simulator, which is YD664 from our textbooks, and it's basically a subset of x86-64 as far as the assembly language goes, and it has its own encoding, which we talked about last time. And it does some changes from x86-64 that were notable. So one is that our textbook authors wanted every instruction name to have a unique set of parameters, but this meant that move kind of didn't work. So to fix that, we renamed move into these four different names. We had IRMoveQ, RRMoveQ, MRMoveQ, and RMoveQ, depending on the type of move. And also, we don't support all types of moves. Like, IMMoveQ isn't an option here. And generally, we said we're going to choose one set of operand types we'll support for an item. So we could do add register register, but we can't do add constant register because that's not one of our options. So if we wanted to simulate that, we'd have to move a constant into a register and then do an add. We also mentioned the conditional move instruction, which isn't x86, but you probably haven't seen it before because it's not something we commonly teach. And it's basically kind of an instruction that does a move based on whether the condition codes say to do the move or not. So it's kind of like a combined conditional jump and move all in one instruction. Something I want to emphasize again is that it does not compare values. It is a conditional move like a conditional jump. It's not a compare and move. And then we looked at the YD664 encoding. We saw that it had instructions of variable lengths, which is going to be something we'll deal with in our first sort of hardware simulation assignment next week. And the encoding table had this sort of primary opcode byte, opcode 4 bits at the beginning of our table, so the uppermost bit of the first byte of the instruction. And that kind of told us what type of instruction it was. And when we were decoding, we used that information to figure out, you know, what the template was for the instruction. We matched that up against the fields. Like we had a field for each register, index, and so on. We went through a bit of that last time. So questions on things we covered last time? And I will go over any quiz question issues on Thursday because I screwed up Kytos. Okay. Yeah.
I don't think we explained the last week's quiz last week's Thursday or Tuesday.
Question is about the quiz that was due last week.
Yes,
we. Serge decided that he didn't feel any questions were worth going over, and no one asked about them. Do you have questions about last week's quiz to ask about?
Not particularly right now. But
okay. If you had some, I would be glad to talk about them. But I think our assumption was that since no one asked, it wasn't a big deal. You know, that's sometimes a thing we'll assume about the quizzes? Is that if no one asked about a question, people understood it well enough, which might not be right, so please ask. Okay, so we've talked about how we encode instructions, so now we're going to talk about making hardware that takes those instructions and runs them. But to talk about that, we first need to talk about, well, how do we make hardware in the first place? And one way we can describe hardware, something I'm going to do a bunch in this class, is I could make pictures. So here is a picture of a piece of hardware. We'll talk about what this count thing is in that picture later. But, you know, I'm saying, oh, I have this thing which does an add one operation that's connected to this funny thing with a triangle on the bottom that is connected then to the add one operation. You know, and that's, we could describe hardware in this kind of way, where we draw pictures and we have things in our pictures to represent components, like whatever that count thing is. And there are even commercial tools for building hardware that work this way. They are not commonly used for processors, and the main reason why is that this kind of gets unwieldy if we're talking about building something as complex as a processor. So we're going to have a different kind of tool, and we're going to have what we'll call a hardware description language. And you can think of this as a programming language for hardware, but it's going to look a lot like the programming languages you're used to. So in the programming languages you're used to, we have kind of a text-based description of the operations we want the machine to do. In this case, we're going to have a text-based description of what the hardware is supposed to do. And like in the programming languages you use for software, this is going to abstract away some details. So when you're writing your code in C or Python, you don't specify every individual instruction, you know, exactly. And that's kind of something that's handled by the compiler for you, those details. Even though you're specifying, you know, what operations need to be done, you aren't specifying all the details. And the same is going to be true in these programming languages for hardware. So for example, we'll say to do like an add. And implementing an add in hardware, there's actually multiple options. It involves, they're typically built from gates, so from those bitwise kind of operations on individual bits. We're not going to be concerned about that. We're going to assume that we have some tool which handles those kind of details for us. Also, like ultimately, we want a description that's going to be built from components that are well-defined, like transistors, and we're going to assume that we'll have a tool which handles dealing with that level of detail. We're not going to talk about how transistors work in this class. We're going to talk about things that we know we can build from transistors, and if you want to know how, take 2330 and/or ECE courses. Because we're going to assume someone else has done that work for us and happily given us this hardware description language, which has basically a compiler which handles those details. And conceptually, what you can think of this compiler doing is rather than compiling our code to, like, assembly language, it's going to compile our code to something someone could use to build a physical circuit. So it's going to give a description of, to make this circuit, put this component here, this component here, this component here. Like, that's what this sort of hardware description language is going to let us do. Now, in this class, we're going to be using a simulator, and our hardware description language implementation, therefore, doesn't bother actually describing exactly how to build it as a circuit. It just figures out enough to simulate it. And this happens in the real world, too. When you're simulating, you don't want to go through all that effort of figuring out exactly how it would lay out in hardware. But conceptually, we could have a compiler that goes to not just a simulation, but to an actual description of how to physically build something. So questions about this idea of what a hardware description language does. Okay. So the tool we're going to be using in this class is called HTLRS. It's something built from this course, and it's based on the language specified in our textbook, but it's a bit different, and it's mostly different in ways that are more flexible for you. So in our textbook, a lot of things that our textbook authors gave their students were very fixed, and we're going to have more choices. So we're going to have parts of the processor that their students didn't have to build that you're going to have to figure out of it. And I'm going to sort of introduce sort of our components in our hardware alongside the way we're going to represent them in this text-based description. And sort of one basic component we're going to have is what I'll call wires. That we need some way of sending a value from one part of the hardware to another. And we're going to kind of assume that this is done by wires that hold individual bits. Maybe hardware could do something different than having one bit per wire. That's going to be kind of our assumption for this class. We're going to kind of guess that probably what they do is that, a high voltage might be 1 and a low voltage might be 0. There's other choices, but you do something like that. So we'll have a physical wire and some voltage will be 1, some voltage will be 0, and we'll just assume for this class that we only represent binary values on each wire. Now, the problem with this is that in our processors, very often we're not passing individual bits around, we're passing bunches of bits. Like here, I want to move a 5-bit value from the left side of this slide to the right side of this slide. And, wires can do this, but we're going to need a bunch of them. And these wires are going to work that we can put a value in one side and they'll propagate to the other, but to send our 5-bit value, we need to put it on all 5 wires at once. And I'm going to really often want these bundles of wires to represent here, like this value 26. So I don't want to draw them like this all the time. Because if we think of our processor, well, our registers are 64 bits. So I need to draw 64 of these on my slides if I was representing things like this. So I'm not going to draw it like this on the slides. So I could have a bit more compact representation like this. But with 64 of these, this would still be really ugly. So I'm going to simplify this further by just drawing a single line, which actually represents this big bundle of wires. Sometimes we'll mark this line to explicitly indicate how big a bundle it is, but often for clutter reasons, I will not include that. Questions on this representation of sort of bundles of wires. And another thing is, as a terminology thing, sometimes I'll just call that thing up top a wire, even though we know it's actually a whole bunch of wires. Okay, so that's our wires. So we also need components that actually do calculations. And we saw some of these earlier when we talked about bitwise operations, that we have these components called gates, which take in some values and do a simple calculation on those values. So with these gates, this is an XOR gate here. So it takes in on 2 different wires that hold individual bits, 2 values, and outputs a function of those values. And we're going to assume that we can build circuits that are kind of like generalized gates, which take in some values, perform a calculation, and produce on some output wire or wires the result of that calculation. And so I might just show something like, this box labeled logic, which computes some function of its input and outputs that on its output. And sort of when this is implemented physically, both for these gates and this sort of logic box, it's going to take some amount of time to do that. So we're going to put in the value 12, and some amount of time later, the function of 12 is going to be what's output on those signals coming out of this box. So as we change that 12, the output will change with some delay. And something to note here is that with our gates, our inputs and outputs were the same size. That doesn't need to be true in general. And so I'm going to show this as boxes. If we were talking about how do we actually build them, it turns out that we can basically combine lots of gates together to compute most functions. For some functions, it might be really awkward, and maybe that would be a problem. We're going to kind of ignore that for this class. That's more of a 2330 and ECE class topic about like what functions can we efficiently compute with a circuit like this. We're going to be focusing on, and it might be kind of surprising, you know, the other parts of the processor. And that might seem like, wait a moment, isn't most of the processor doing the math? And turns out, from many perspectives, no. Most of the processor's work is like bookkeeping stuff. And we're going to be talking about a lot of work to do all the bookkeeping type of work for the processor and not the actual calculations. So questions on our logic? Yeah? So the question, do the gates only take in single binary values? So the gates I represented like this. When you see this on a diagram, generally it means that these are single bit values. Sometimes you'll see, and probably not going to show it for this class, but sometimes you'll see sort of a version of the gate that takes in more of them, but it's still not a bundle of wires. If we're doing a bitwise operation, we typically have an array of these. And maybe on a diagram, they try to have some more compact way of representing that. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? And I forgot to repeat questions. I should remember to do that. Okay. So we talked about, yes, so we have gates here. Yes, typically single bit when they're drawn like this. And this kind of generalization, do more. And I talked about sort of wires conceptually. Let's talk about how we're going to represent wires in our sort of hardware programming language. And this is just a syntax we've chosen. It's arbitrary. There's different ones for different, you know, more real hardware programming languages. So we're going to give this bundle of wires a name. And we're going to call it wire, even though it's really a bundle of wires. So the name in this case is foo. When I'm declaring it, I'm specifying that it's a bundle of 5 bits. And I can say what it's connected to with an assignment operator. So this is not going to be like your assignment in C, and we'll see some examples later. It's just going to say it's connected to this value. It's not evaluated at a particular time. Either foo is connected to 26, or it's not connected to anything. It's not, for example, the case that foo would have a different value here or here. Where we do this connection is not going to matter. Foo is connected to a value and has that value no matter what, or it's not connected to a value because we didn't do any of this connection operation is equals assignment type operation. We'll see examples of that in a bit. So when we went to do calculations, that logic, we're just going to write things that look like C expressions and assume our hardware programming language implementation handles converting that to a bunch of gates and so on. So for example, here I have a bitwise AND of two-bit values, one of which is contained on wire A, the other of which is contained on wire B, which is really, those are both bundles of two wires. And so if we were sort of compiling this down to a circuit, that circuit would end up with these two AND gates to implement that bitwise operation. And so in this case, I've connected A and B to some constant value, and I've connected C to the output of this box of logic that does the bitwise AND. And because this is connection, the order doesn't matter. These are both the same. It doesn't matter the order I write it in. Basically, when we're simulating this, we're going to look for, you know, when I try to evaluate what is C here, I'm going to say, how is B set? It doesn't matter where it's set. I'm going to say, how is it set? What is it connected to? Because we're thinking about this being a circuit where if we put a value on B, it's going to propagate down that wire. Doesn't matter. When we decided to put the value on B, that's just how it's going to work physically, and that's what we're going to simulate. And that means that the order here is not going to affect the outcome we get. Yes? So the question is, if order doesn't matter, when do these things happen? Physically, or?
The reason why order doesn't matter is because it happens concurrently.
Question, the reason why order doesn't matter is because it happens concurrently, basically. That is one way of thinking about it. We haven't really talked about what concurrently means. I would say that some things can happen at the same time. So, for example, in this circuit, these two AND operations probably happen at the actual same time. And some things need to happen at different times. So, for example, if we put this C value into a sort of a circuit that computed plus 1 and made the output go to D, we can't actually be computing the ANDs for C at the same time as we compute the plus 1 for D. Right, so there is an order there, but the order is determined by the layout of the circuit, not by the order I write the code. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Yeah.
If we were to say, Y of C was a bundle of 3 wires or something, would this not, compile the simulator or something?
The question is, if we were to change C from a 2 to a 3, would this not compile? I should remember, but I don't. If it does compile, it will just silently put a 0 at the beginning. I forget whether I enforce that the width matches for bit by time. Other questions? Okay, so we also can represent, for example, an addition operator. And if you know about how hardware works, you'll know that, this is a way more complicated circuit than the previous one, but we're just assuming someone else handles that. And you might say, wait a moment, this has a carry bit. What happens to that? It just gets truncated. Goes away. Okay, so we know how to do additions. So let's think of making a counter. So here's my idea for a counter. We're going to have a 3-bit wire going through my plus 1. So I try to write this in my hardware description language. Here it is. And what's going to happen? Well, let's think about how this should work. So let's say initially somehow the wire is 0. We haven't talked about initial values. Let's assume we can have some initial value that's all zeros. Okay, but it's going to be set somehow. Okay. And what we'd like to happen is, it's initially 0. It goes through the plus 1 after some amount of time. We don't know exactly how long, but after some amount of time, it goes through the plus 1, and we get 1, then 2, then 3. That's what we'd like to happen. We're going to see that there's a problem here, that this is not really going to work out. So one problem here is going to be that, if you try to put this in our hardware programming language implementation, it will tell you no. Just no. Circular dependency detected. X depends on X. You might say, wait a moment. We kind of need to be able to count in our processor. If we can't do it like this, how do we do it? We'll talk about that later. We're going to need a different type of component. But here, the problem is, it wants to figure out what X is supposed to be. And remember, order doesn't matter. So to figure out what X is supposed to be, we have to see what X is supposed to be. And that's kind of a problem. That's not really going to work out. And so it just says, no, I can't do that. But we could physically build a circuit that looks like this. And would it work? And, well, the answer is probably not really. Let's talk about why. And this is going to motivate why we really want an extra component to handle this kind of operation. And to think about why, let's think about how these individual bits are represented. So we want to go from 0 to 1 to 2 to 3. And if we think of the least significant bit, that's going to go from 0 to 1 to 0 to 1 to 0 to 1. And in our physical wire, this is going to be represented as a voltage. That's going to go from a low voltage to a high voltage. But because this is a physical thing, we can't actually instantaneously go from a low to a high voltage. There's going to be some in-between voltages, just because physically it's not going to be possible to instantaneously go from like 0 volts to 3 volts. And so I've kind of exaggerated that here with like what a graph of that might be. But a problem here is that we are sending this in-between value to the add 1 circuit. So in order to understand how this behaves, we need to understand how does this add 1 handle that in-between value. Is it going to treat it as adding 1 to 1 early? Well, you might say, well, maybe that's not really a problem. But then we have to consider that, well, we have other values here too, right? Like our second bit here. And another issue here is that these are two separate wires with, you know, two separate values. And it seems very easy that these changes might not quite be in sync. And that means there might be sort of some time here where we end up accidentally seeing 1-1 from transitioning from 1 to 0 and from 0 to 1 at the same time. So we have these kind of extra ghost values, and that's likely to make our add 1 circuit produce additional weird values. And kind of our net result is that this circuit is not likely to be stable. That because we're trying to send our add 1 circuit these values that are changing, and then sending the results of those changing values back to the add 1 circuit, it's likely to kind of cascade and produce all these weird results and not give us 0, 1, 2, 3, but give us like 0, 1, 2, 0, 3, and a bunch of other weird values. So this is not likely to be a well-behaved circuit. So we have these sort of behaviors because of these intermediate values doing weird things to our add 1 circuit. And maybe we could do the electrical engineering work to make that not a big deal. But that's not going to be our solution. We're going to have some other way of doing this kind of work without having to worry about these values from the in-between results of the add 1 calculation kind of being bad. We're going to want to hide those values and only deal with stable values. So questions about the problem we have here before I talk about how we're going to solve it. Okay, so we have this problem that we're sending add 1 these incomplete values that it was all computing. And, you know, kind of a fundamental issue here is that like add 1 never stops working, right? It's just always computing plus 1. But we kind of do want it to stop. We want it to stop so we can get the answer to the first, you know, 0 plus 1 is 1. And then we want it to stop so we can get the answer to 1 plus 1 is 2. But to do that, we need to have a place to store its input so it stays the same. And also a place to store its output so we can use it later. So we're going to need some extra element that stores information. And that extra element we're going to add, well, we're going to have two types we're going to use, registers and memory. We're going to first talk about registers. So we're going to add a register, which is what this box with a triangle notched out on the bottom represents. And that register is going to store a value. And it's going to store it in a way that we control. And this is going to allow us to get the actual 0, 1, 2, 3 output we want without having weird intermediate values that make the add 1 circuit produce other weird values that, you know, ends up not doing our K counting that we were trying to do. And the fundamental way the register is going to work is that it's going to store a value, and it's not going to update the value it's storing all the time. It's only going to update it when we tell it. And we're going to have a periodic signal we call a clock signal that tells it when it to update, and we're going to choose to have that signal happen only after the add1's output has stopped changing. So we're never going to try to store the in-between values. We're only going to store the sort of final value of a calculation. And then we're not going to store the next set of values until add1 has completed the next calculation, and so on. So if we think of registers, so have our picture representation of a register. So we're going to have this thing, a clock signal. And I've kind of represented the clock signal as sort of a changing voltage. And the clock signal is going to try to have these sharp rising edges. And the registers we're using in this class are going to look for that rising edge of this clock signal. And when that happens, they're going to take their input. So let's say this green represents 1, and they're going to copy that 1 to their output after that. So that would be how our register would go from outputting 0 to 1, for example. And then since they're outputting 1, whatever circuit they're feeding can use that 1. So if we have our counter example, it would take that 1 and add 1 to it to produce 2, which would be this purple output here, and on the next rising edge of the clock signal, we say, okay, now I can copy that 2 and make that the value I'm outputting now. So we have this clock signal that controls when the register acts, and when it acts, it copies its input to its output. And because we're controlling when it does that, we can ensure that we're only copying inputs that are completely computed. We don't have any in-between values. And because it holds its output the rest of the time, we can ensure that our circuits that do computation are getting a stable input for a long enough time for them to do their work and compute their outputs. So something not shown here is I didn't draw the clock signal. So I drew our input signal and our output. If I was drawing the clock signal, I'd draw it here. That's what the notch represents. But typically, I'm not going to draw the wires containing our clock signal. We're going to have, in our circuits, we're going to have one clock signal for every single register in the circuit. So if I have a bunch of registers, they're all going to use the same clock signal. So everything in the circuit's going to work in lockstep. No, physically, you don't have to do this, but this is how all the processors we're going to talk, processor designs we're going to talk about are going to work. We'll have a single clock. So everyone's going to do one step of the calculation, then we're going to have this rising edge of the clock, and we're going to store the values from that step, and now we're outputting new values, we're going to do the next step of the calculation. Until the next rising edge of the clock, we're going to store the values from that next step, and so on. So we're going to have this global clock signal that kind of separates the steps our processor is taking. Questions about registers and the clock signal. Okay, so I drew a picture of this counter circuit. Sorry, yes, back there. What does the diagonally shaded parts mean? So this is representing. So this region here, this is meant to represent the changing input. But so in this example, our input was initially 1, and it goes to 2, but in the middle there's some weird intermediate values, and that's representing those weird intermediate values. Because of how our register works, we don't care about those values because we're not checking the input until that rising edge of the clock. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah. The question is, if we're, are we storing the input at every rising edge? Yes. So we're looking at the input just before the rising edge, storing that, and after the rising edge, that's our output. Other questions? Okay, so I have the picture representation. How are we gonna represent these in text? So let's, here I have the text representation that we're gonna use for this circuit. So we need to talk about what the syntax is here. So I have this block to declare the register. So this is a called a register bank. I can actually declare multiple related registers here. Here I've just declared the count register, but I could like add another line for the, another register that would work the same way. In this case, I only have one. And when I declare this register, I have to specify two letters. The first one is always lowercase, second one is always uppercase. And these represent the input and output side of the register. So in this case, all the signals that go into the register are going to be represented with a lowercase x. All the signals that come out are going to be represented with an uppercase y. And then I specify a name for the register, and you can see that the signals combine that name with those letters. So like I have lowercase x underscore count, my name is count, the lowercase x is the letter I chose for the input side. And so that's my input wire, lowercase x, and my output wire is uppercase y. And we can see on the diagram, so the input wire represents this thing going in with to this green dot here. The output wire represents what's coming out of the blue dot, which happens to be sent all the way into this add one circuit, which is represented by this sort of plus one operation here. I also need to specify when I declare my register the initial value, because in our simulation we want to know when the simulation starts, what should that value B, or if we're building a physical processor, when I reset my processor, what should this register become? And don't have it highlighted. We also needed the size in bits. So questions about our syntax for these registers. Yes?
So why are we setting the, I guess, it sort of confuses me how we're setting like the input x count equal to the output plus one. Like for just the line that's like x count equal to y count.
So the question is, this last line, when we're setting the input to the output plus one, like what does that mean?
I guess so.
So that is representing this plus one operation, and that it is connected to the output of the register, this y count, and that it goes into, this result goes into the input of the register, this x count. So it's representing that plus one, and we're saying that the plus one operation is computing this value, y count plus one. And we take that value and we place it as the register's input. Now, the way the register works, we know that the input doesn't take effect immediately, right? So it's not the case that this is sort of a circular dependency, because we're not going to change y count based on x count until that rising edge of the clock. Does that answer your question? Yes.
Can we like dynamically add more wires as the number gets bigger, or is it limited by
the question is, can we dynamically add more wires as the number gets bigger? So here, this counter is going to overflow. How is that going to work? And in this case, when the counter goes over 7, it goes back to 0. And because we're trying to represent physical hardware, we have to choose a number of bits we have. We can't change that. So if we wanted to support more bits, we'd have to use some other strategy. So if we wanted to like support a dynamic number of bits, we'd have to use some other strategy, which we probably can't think of what that would be until we talk about memory, but probably some strategy that involves something like memory. And that's a lot more hardware. Yes? What I mean earlier when I said related registers? So for now, we're not going to have very many registers that we want outside of the register file, which will be implemented in a different way. But later on, it's going to turn out we're going to want to pass a whole bunch of values from an instruction, sort of like, for example, we'll want to have a register that stores like the instruction's opcode and the instruction's register number. So those would be two different registers that are very related. And yes, back there? Yeah.
So like you define it as like two letters and then there's like a variable inside the register.
Yeah.
And then kind of like outside the scope of the register, we access the variable by using this like x underscore syntax. Is that like always what is used or?
So the question is, we define these two letters, and then we access the corresponding signals outside the register. Does it work? Is that how that works? Yes. And I would say that these things, I call them wires or signals, right? So basically, I would think of it as the register block sets up some wires, and then we have to connect them.
Can I
have more than just one register in there? Absolutely. More than one? Can I have more than one register block?
Yeah.
Also, absolutely. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So we have this sort of our counter circuit here, and so if we simulate this, what will happen is that initially, Y count will be 0, because the register holds 0 initially, and therefore it outputs 0 all the way on this circuit here, and 0 is going into this add 1, and that add 1, before we go on to our next step, is going to compute 1. And so that means sitting on the input to this register will be the value 1, before we go on to our next step, before our first rising edge of the clock. Then we have this rising edge of that clock signal, so we had our clock signal. So we have this initial startup, so we have start here, and then we have the first rising edge, and at that first rising edge, it will have been long enough for us to compute 1 from 0, and we'll copy that value and switch to, we'll copy this value here to get 1, and we'll be sending 1 down this layer and computing 2, which we can see here. So we have, after the first rising edge, we have 1 being output from the register that goes to the add 1. The add 1 before, after not too long, computes 2. 1, 0, and then we have the next rising edge, and we're going to have 2 be output by the register, and going to compute 3. That's going to happen as our clock signal tells the circuit 1 to advance to the next step. So questions about this timeline here? Yes. Question, the registers that can hold multiple bits at the same time, the registers hold exactly the number of bits we specify. Yes? So the question is, nothing in the code suggests this is a loop where it keeps decreasing, it's just in the circuitry? Yes, so the way our circuits are going to work are, we're going to set the register, they're just going to keep setting the registers based on you know, at that rising edge, and then we'll have new values and we'll compute again. So like kind of the hardware kind of inherently runs this loop with this clock signal, and that we're going to want to have the loop end up doing eventually for a processor, like executing instructions instead of just adding numbers. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Earlier when you said you could do multiple related registers in the bank, what does that mean exactly?
So that means I would have multiple, I could have another register here, so foo colon say 4 with an initial value, and then I could have like x, do x foo equals something, and just have it foo that operates alongside count. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Other questions? Yeah.
So the words are called registers, and the whole thing is called register.
So the question is, each value we call a register, and the whole thing is called a register bank? Yeah, that's the terminology we'll use. But you might see different terminology from other people for this sort of thing. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so here I have some code that uses a register bank with two registers and sets them both in a way that they're kind of interdependent. And their initial values are 1 and 1. So my question is, after two rising edges, so you know, after we advance two steps, what are the values of YA and YB? Those are the outputs of these two registers. Check with your neighbors if you agree on what's supposed to happen. Question, what does the 4 equals 1 part mean? Okay. So this is our name. This is the width and bits. And this is the initial value. So the question is, those 4 bits represent 1? Yeah, so yeah, which means that it's really 0001.
Thank you.
Okay, who'd like some more time? Two people? I guess while you're doing I have, this is my ugly drawing of what this circuit is. A's output goes into both additions. B's output goes into the addition for A. And the addition for B, because we have, goes into the addition for A, right? Because YB appears here. And then B's, A's input also, which is XA here, also goes into the addition for B's input, which is what this line I drew over in green represents. Okay, so who thinks it's A, B, C, D, E, F, okay, G, H, okay, so you have a plurality for F with some disagreement. So the way I would usually figure this out, so one thing, I could draw that circuit and like trace what happens on that circuit. I find that very error prone. There's a reason we're using sort of text representations also. I'm not sure you can draw this circuit without crossings, but I don't want to bother figuring out that. I'll just do this other method where I'll just make a table. So my table is going to look very much like the table I have here, just with more columns. So I'm going to have XA, XB, YA, and YB. And we know initially the outputs are 1 and 1. Those are capital YA, capital YB are the outputs. So those are the two things that are coming out of our registers before we stored anything new. That's the initial value they have because that's what we said. And I can look at these lines to figure out what they are. So I want to figure out what XB is. Well, to figure that out, I need to figure out XA first. So let's look at XA. XA is YA plus YB, so that's 2. Now that I know what XA is, I can figure out XB. So XB is XA, 2, plus YA, 1. So I have 3, and this is, you know, before the first rising edge. So then we know that we're going to have that rising edge of the clock signal, and these registers are going to copy their inputs to their outputs. So then I'm going to have after my first rising edge, and we're going to copy this XA and XB to the outputs of the registers YA and YB. So that's going to give us 2 and 3 here. And there's a question over here.
Yeah, so how do you get the value of XA?
How do I get the value of XA? So I know here I'm saying that XA is set by putting YA and YB through an addition operation.
So like it's not like a variable declaration where you need to declare before like orders?
So the question is not like a variable declaration where you need to declare before, yeah, the order doesn't matter? Yes. So just like because in the circuit, this is just representing here that the input of X is connected to an adder that adds the output of A and the output of B. So that's what it's representing. And when we're simulating that, to figure out what that adder does, we first need to figure out what's the output of A and B. You know, and that's what we're going to do. And if we have to do some extra steps, so like for XB here, we have to do an extra step where we have to say, oh, this, we need to figure out the output of A, so the input to A before we can figure it out, we'll do that. Just like the circuit will do that because, well, it's going to look on that wire that comes from that the input to A, and it's going to see what's on that wire and just naturally going to be the result of the app. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Yes, back there. So the question, the inputs don't become the outputs until after the whole code is ran? Yes, and the reason that's going to happen is because we're going to set our clock signal up so it takes long enough between the rising edges that we can completely do the additions or whatever other operations we're doing sort of in the logic part of our circuit. Does that answer your question? Yes. The question is, can I relate the drawing to the numbers I have here? Sure. So let's start with the output of, so initially, the output of A is, is 1. So we have 1 going out on this wire here, and therefore, one of our inputs to the top adder, the one going to A is 1, and one of the inputs to the bottom adder, the one going into B, B is 1. We also, similarly, have here, the output of B is 1, so that means the 1 is going into the adder that goes into A. So I can see I'm adding 1 and 1, and I'm getting out, therefore, 2. And the 2 is going to be the input to register A, so that's going to be its output later on. And it's also the other input to the bottom adder. So the bottom adder is adding 1 and 2, and we're going to therefore get 3 coming out into B. Does that answer your question? Yes, over there.
So why are we able to work with x underscore a being 2? Why are we able to do that before we actually send 2?
The question is, why are we able to work with x underscore a being 2 before we actually set it to 2?
Yeah.
So these assignments don't represent the order in which things happen. They represent physical connections in our circuit. So what they're trying to represent is this circuit here. So, you know, and physically, you know, what's going to happen is values are going to propagate down wires just based on what's connected to what. Now, when we're simulating this, you might say, that means our simulator can't just apply these operations in order, and indeed it can't. So the simulator for this, it's going to try to do what the circuit's doing, and rather than running these in order, it's going to say, well, to figure out what happens to XB, I first need to figure out what happens to XA. And the kind of hardware is doing that because XB is looking at, through that adder, is looking at the output from X going into XA. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? So continuing my manual reasoning here, so I had, after the first writing edge, I had YA is 2 and YB is 3. And so to compute XA, I'd add 2 and 3 to get 5. To compute XB, I add my current XA, which is 5, and my current YA, which is 2, to get 7. And those, after the next rising edge, are going to become the outputs A and B. And so I don't need to bother to, I could compute what XA and XB are in the next clock cycle after the next rising edge, but I don't need to. Okay. So questions about how I did this? Yes?
The outputs become the inputs after the clock rises.
Question, the outputs become the inputs after the clock rises? The inputs become the outputs.
Okay.
Inputs to the register become the outputs. We're showing we have this, these arrows because the X becomes the Y. This picture. Other questions? Yeah?
Is the third rule representing after the second?
Question is the third row after the second rising edge? Yes. After two rising edges. Anything else? Okay. So we have registers. We're going to want some other components that store data. And one of the more useful ones is going to be that, well, we need to actually have our instructions. If we're building a processor, we need the machine code somewhere. So we need something that stores the machine code for us to access. And that's going to be a component we call an instruction memory. And the way the instruction memory is going to work is that we're going to put in the address we want, and within the same clock cycle, it's going to give us the machine code at that address. So it's kind of going to look like our logic circuits. Like with our logic circuits, like we wanted to like add 1 to a number, we put in the number and we got out the number plus 1. Here we put in an address and we get out the value at that address in the same kind of way. We're going to talk later on in the semester about maybe more about what's really going on in this instruction memory, because this seems like maybe a little simplified, given that, you know, we're trying to hold lots of values, and maybe that's not so fast, but we'll talk about that later in the semester when we talk about caches, which are going to be how this, what this actually is. And in our HCLRS here, we're going to have our program counter, or sorry, a value called PC, a wire called PC here. That's going to be the input to our instruction memory. This is the names from our textbook. I probably would not have chosen these names if I weren't using our textbook, but I want to be consistent with our textbook, so if you're reading, things won't be so confusing. So there's a wire called PC that is built into our simulator because this component's built in. And there's a wire called i10bytes, which is the output of the instruction memory, the value at that address. And as you can guess from the name, it's called i10bytes, so you get 10 bytes. You might say, what if I don't need 10 bytes? Well, too bad, you're getting 10. If you're dealing with an instruction that's shorter than 10 bytes, you just don't use all of them. So these are two built-in signals that do something in the simulator. There's one other that's going to be kind of important, and that is a signal called stat. And this is just to tell the simulator whether to keep going or not. If we think of how this would be in sort of physical hardware, this might be the signal that controls like the power for the machine. So when we're doing our simulation, we need to know when to stop. So your processor is going to set this to a value to say whether to stop or keep going. Yeah, in a real machine, probably this would be similar to like setting the value to tell the machine to power off or not on whatever controls the power. And so there's a signal called stat, and there's some constants we define, which are just predefined 3-bit numbers that represent whether to stop, keep going, and also you can stop and have the simulator report an error. Which are what the other values there are. So invalid instruction value means stop and have the simulator write invalid instruction to the command line or that you ran it from. So questions are on either of these. Yes?
Is this stat wire, is that another input to the instruction memory, or is that totally separate?
Question, is the stat wire an input to the instruction memory? No, it's totally separate. It's an input to the simulator, basically. And I'll usually represent it as an input to, on diagrams, as an input to like a register that hypothetically the simulator reads. But we'll not show that detail. Okay, so now that we have a way to read instructions and a way to stop our simulation or have it keep going, we can make a processor. So here's my processor. I'm going to choose the simplest subset of y86 I can. So I'm going to choose one instruction to implement, and that's nop. So what does the nop instruction do? It just goes to the next instruction. That's all it does. And nop instruction, if you remember it's encoding, it's 1 byte. So it's encoded as, remember our coding chart, we had nop, which is just one box with one, we had that separately, but it was 1 and 0, right? That was its encoding. So it's 1 byte, 1 0. That's the only instruction we implement. And if you have a different instruction, well, we don't implement it, so it's not gonna work. So here's my processor that implements that. I'm gonna have a register that holds my current program counter value that tells me what instruction I'm running, and I'm gonna take the output of that register and use it to fetch my nop instruction. But since I'm assuming all instructions are nop, I don't actually care about what I get out. I'm just going to say, if it's not a nop, I don't support it anyways, not going to bother. We'll fix that later. Obviously, we want to actually check what the instruction is and do something nice with it. And I'm going to do the other work the nop instruction does, which is adding 1 to go to the next instruction and making that be my program counter in the next cycle. So with this design, I'm going to run one instruction per cycle. So I'm going to run the first knob in the first cycle, the next knob in the second cycle, and I'm assuming my memory just contains knobs. So a way I might define this is I'll declare my register to hold the current instruction location I'm at, my program counter. And I'm going to have an initial value I've just chosen arbitrarily that I'm going to start at 0. And it's going to be 64 bits because that's how big our addresses are in Y86, and that's how big the instruction memory expects its input to be. And remember that the lowercase p represents the input, the uppercase f represents the output. So I'm going to represent this add 1 by saying I take the output, add 1, and put that into the input. I'm going to assign that to the instruction memory. I'd say, why are we bothering doing this? So because our simulator is designed to build a processor, it requires you to read the instruction memory or it says something's wrong. So we're going to do that. And I'm also going to set the stat signal to tell the simulator it's OK to keep going. That's also a mandatory. And this here is a minimum thing we can run in our simulator. And there's going to be one other thing we need to actually run this, which is that we need an assembly file for it to run on, to load into the instruction memory. So there's a program we talked about before, YAS, which converts an assembly file to this sort of executable file, which is confusingly has the extension .yo. So that's the format that our simulator is going to take to load into the memory. So I'll demo this next time since we're close to out of time, but I'll show you sort of what you'd expect doing things in lab next week. So you'll create an assembly file like this. We'll assemble it to get our .yo file. And then when we pass our HCL program and that YO file to the simulator, we get this bunch of output. And we get so much output because it says it times out after lots of cycles because we never set the stop. And we'll talk about fixing that, you know, we'll look at how the simulator works some more next time and also talk about fixing this problem that we never set when to stop. That's all I have for it.